Welcome to The Lob, your home of in-depth coverage and analysis by These Football Times, a movement of journalism you can trust. Each week, we endeavour to bring you the very best coverage of the game, exploring stories from the past and present with analysis by expert guests from around the world. Find more of our award-winning content online and in print. In the meantime, enjoy the podcast.
Hello and welcome to another edition of the Lob podcast with These Football Times. My name is Stuart Horsfield, and it is with mixed emotions that we come with this podcast. One, happy emotion, great game, great final, great guest. But on the other hand, last episode of what has been a fantastic series. Gary, you were series curator, as I now like to call you, is now my new name for you.
Steve.
Oh, Gary's got to be somewhat silent for much of this podcast, I believe. He's certainly when we can talk about the semi final.
Well, I'm sure we'll spend plenty of time on that as well.
Well,
So first of all, obviously, like I say, guys, you know, it's the last episode. It's been a brilliant series. You must be looking forward to it a little bit, Gary.
It's, you know, Stevie's series, but it'll be interesting that we get to the, as you mentioned, the semi-final and discuss how Liverpool managed to get to the final without actually getting a goal, officially. without the ball never crossing the line, and somehow they got put them through, but, you know, that's these things happen. That's fine. I mean, okay, and on the balance of play, Liverpool deserved to get through anyway, so...
And Stephen,
I could be, you know, there's a sort of great quote I always sort of hold dear, you know, be humble in victory, humble in defeat, and be magnanimous in victory.
As always. And I apologise, Stephen, but clearly it'll be more than made up for with the topic of this particular edition.
Oh, most definitely. It's actually a little bit surreal as well because. Having gone through the series and it's finals that you've, you know, some of them have been before my lifetime. You know, some of them you've watched from a distance. This is one I was at. So, you know, it does have a slight surreal edge to it.
I mean, this is a game that's, I'm not saying has been talked to death. It's not. But it's a game when you're looking at fans that, you know, we've done this series and we've come up with some. Well, obviously, the last episode we went north of the border to Scotland for one of the Scottish finals. We've had classic FA Cup final replay. We've had arguably the greatest final of all time with the 1970 World Cup final. We've had finals where it's been about everything but the football. But I guess this final is probably the final that literally has everything. Bar a red card, it has everything.
Well, completely. It has the whole lot. You know, there's a team that's beaten in 45 minutes. There's a team that resurrects itself within a mad six-minute spell. You know, it has, you know, goal line clearances. It has, you know, the most insane double save imaginable. It just has the whole lot, the penalty shootouts, you know, it defies gravity, yet, you know, everything just fell into place perfectly. And, you know, even in my mind's eye now, I can still see the pitch from where it was stood.
I'm sure we'll touch on your experiences at this game, but obviously we need to introduce our special guest. And there's a question I've got ready for him already. That I've just thought of while we were chatting. And hopefully most of you will recognise him. It's the voice behind These Football Times Coaches Forum. I think he's going to bring a bit of intellect, shall we say, a bit of coaching and football intellect to this episode. And it's Mr. John Townsend. John, welcome to the podcast.
Thank you so much for having me.
Always a pleasure. So as we said, it's the 2005 Champions League final. It's Liverpool versus AC Milan. It's everything you could possibly want from a cup final. Sometimes the great games are in the earlier rounds or in the semi-finals, and the finals never quite live up to the billing. But this one, you know, lives up to its billing and some. You know, the series was all about choosing finals, any football final from anywhere in the world, international level, domestic, continental level. I would say why have you picked this one, but I guess there's a fair few obvious answers to that. But why did you choose this final?
Oh, well, to avoid the obvious, I think the final itself, to me, if I remove the fandom supporter aspect of it, it was an encapsulating game from the perspective of you have two sides that, and I wrote about this once, about this game being played two different realms, one on paper and then one on the pitch. And one of the things that I remember was I was in university at the time, and I was playing, and I remember getting on the train to go to a pub before I was even of drinking age, and I had to go to an Italian pub because they were one of the only places that I knew that would let one, an underage person in, and two, that would be showing this game in Italian. And it was aired on ESPN, and I had a buddy of mine who wanted to watch it. He was in his family from Italy, and so we went, and I remember watching the game there and just kind of being lost in a sea of, you know, Milan fans. But what was interesting was I left and I went across the street to another sports bar where it was on an English broadcast, and it was probably the best thing I could have done, because that second half was a completely different experience. And one of the things that sticks out for me was the effort that I took to find this game, because I had watched Champions League before, and you're usually seeing, you know, other people's boyhood teams in it. And this one for me was stuff that my family in England and my father talked about when Liverpool was in finals in their era. And for me, yes, you know, you had the treble winning side from the early 2000s, but this was different. This was, you know, Rafa Benitez's first, you know, year there. They weren't doing well in the League 11, you know, away losses. And it was just this, they found their way, they clawed their way, controversially maybe, to this final against, I mean, footballing royalty with this Milan side. So to me, it was just like, well, David versus Goliath in a lot of ways. And so it just stuck out to me from a personal level, but then from the game, it was just incredible. So, and it's one of those things where finals are the stuff of dreams. And again, I think that this was one of the, it's either a dream or a nightmare for whatever side you fall on, but that's why it stuck out for me.
I'm going to come to Gary and Stephen in a second, but I'm really sorry, John. I just want to ask you another question.
Sure.
Obviously, your coaching knowledge, you know, is excellent. You know, listen to the discussions that you have on the other podcast, and this is something that's always fascinated me in terms of coaches who take coaching really, really seriously. And that's when you watch games like that. Do you watch them as a coach, and do you see the fallibility through a coach's eyes, or can you still enjoy the game for the game's sake as it's played out with all its errors, all its beauty? And, you know, can you still watch it as a fan, I guess, is what I'm trying to say.
Oh, what a beautiful question. And it's complex, because at the time this game was taking place, I was 19 years old, and I had only coached like a recreational team. I was playing collegiately, so I had no desire to extend the discussion on tactics and anything like that, because that's all that's relevant to me as a player. And what was interesting about this game was, as I saw it unfold and I saw the lineup and I saw how the teams had set up, I realized just how much of a chess match this was going to be. What happens, though, I think after the first minute, is I lose all tactical sense when I'm watching this game. Once Maldini scores, like, I mean, it's a sloppy foul, and then it's, you know, a clipped ball in, and he smashes a volley off the ground into the roof. I mean, it's like, so the oldest at the time, the oldest player to ever score in a Champions League final has scored. It's first minute. This is going to be a slaughter. It's going to be an onslaught. And I actually let myself forget the chess match, and I just start getting wrapped up in the fandom. And remind you, I'm around Milan fans who are they go from sipping, you know, espressos and beer to shouting and, you know, getting very, very passionate. And most of the people in this place that I'm watching this at are Italian. They're not American. They're, you know, they're from Italy. And I am completely just lost in this fact that Liverpool is clinging to the game and Milan is getting into their ascendancy in the first minute. And it's one of those things that when I look back at it tactically, this is going to be a, you know, Catenaccio. This is going to be a lock and key. They're going to lock this in. And it's, and you start seeing it in Liverpool in the second minute almost, where they start playing from the wings, diagonal balls into a defensive line that is Maldini, Nesta, Stam, Cafu. Like it just becomes almost comical. But, you know, as the first half unfolded, it was almost the best thing that could have happened, because tactically, Milan has undone themselves, and we'll talk about that later on. But yeah, it's hard. It's very hard to put the coaching side, as you know, a student of the game, it's hard to set that aside. But when it goes as crazy as this game did, it's, you just get lost in it, to be honest.
Great answer. Like I say, it's always something that's fascinated me whenever I've talked to, like I say, coaches. Can you still watch them as fans and get lost in the game? And it's good to hear that can still happen, because it's such an important part of the game. Stephen and Gary, got a question each for you two before we sort of get back to this game. For you, Stephen, where does this sit in and amongst your sort of six Champions League final wins, or European Cup wins? I'd love to call it the Champions League final. I am of a certain generation, but in terms of European Cup / Champions League wins, where does this final sit for you?
There's some form of detachment really from the first four, because it's a different landscape. The landscape has altered. You know, we're in that tournament by the back door. This isn't a Liverpool that's anywhere near the vintage of the ones that won the previous ones. You know, with the Champions League, you still become champions of Europe, but it's a different path to get there. That said, you know, as a active match-going supporter, you know, I watched the other ones as a kid, watched them on the television. You know, I was at this one, fully invested in mid-20s it had been, I suppose. You know, it was just peak years for me, kind of like globetrotting and up and down the country watching Liverpool absolutely everywhere. So, you know, while this wasn't the same as the previous ones, this belonged to me.
That's a great answer, like you said, that, you know, that it actually, I suppose, like you say, as a European Cup fan, it actually belongs to you, and not so much your generation, but like you say, you were there, and obviously people who were there sort of in the late 70s and early 80s for their European Cup finals, you know, I guess they belong to that generation. Gary, for you, the European Cup final as an entity, is it, not sure how to word this, I don't mean, is it the most important, is it domestically or at club football level, is it the most important game? Is it the biggest game? Yes, you have the Copa Libertadores, and, you know, which is the continental equivalent, but in terms of the, you know, the global game at club level, you know, is the European Cup the ultimate trophy to win? There's been some great players that haven't won it, and some great world on a world stage that haven't won it. But is it, you know, is it the best, or is it the greatest competition to win?
I guess, you know, being Eurocentric, then I'm going to say yes, because, you know, it is the greatest club competition on the European continent. If you're sitting in Brazil, Argentina, Uruguay, Peru, Colombia, or wherever, you might say the Copa Libertadores is more important. So, I mean, I guess it's difficult to judge, and, you know, you can't make an objective judgment, because we're all subjective and judging from where we are and the way we look at things. So, yeah, you know, I suppose yes, I'd have to say that, you know, from my perspective, yeah, it is the most important club competition in the world.
Does it, I mean, again, just before we go to this final, because obviously the final is this great game in itself, but has it, I mean, you, sorry, Gary, but you've seen more European Cup finals than we have. Does it, you know, is it a competition that is renowned for great finals, or, you know, was this, you know, relatively a one-off?
There's been some dramatic finals. like 1999, the Man United Bayern Munich one, the Chelsea Bayern Munich one was also very dramatic, but perhaps not great matches per se. Not great finals. And I think, you know, when the stakes are so high, it's quite often the case that, you know, the final becomes something where it's more important not to lose than it is to win almost, because it's so important. So I don't think, you know, you could say the history of the European Cup, I mean, I'll go back to 1967 Celtic, is probably the first one I can remember. And, you know, there's been some decent games. There's been a few exceptional games, and by God, this was one of them.
It was. And, you know, and obviously, you know, the reason why we're here is for this game. So, you know, John, you mentioned the sort of the back four of that Milan side, but you look at the starting 11 of that Milan side, and it was, you know, it is just almost a European all-star 11 that sort of congregated in Milan to line up in this final. And I'm sure, you know, Stephen will come and have his point of view on the Liverpool side that they match up against. But in terms of both sides sort of getting to the final, you know, certainly one of the best sides in Europe was in the final. I'm not sure the second best side in Europe was their opponent.
Yeah, I think that's one of the truisms of this final. I think let's say seven of the starting 11 had won the Champions League final 2 years prior for Milan. And so these are, if you look at the press and the media's coverage prior to the match, I mean, the Milan players are cool. They've been there before. They expect to win. They've won their group. This is a well-oiled machine, and they have a blend of role players and stars that I think even Steven Gerrard said, I mean, in every position, this is the best players in the world. And you look at, they're there because they're supposed to be there. And one of the things about looking at the Liverpool press prior to the game, and I obviously in hindsight did a lot of thinking about this, and someone asked Liverpool players, what's it like to be so close to the European Cup during an interview? And I think Sami Kupia said, I just want to focus on the game, the match. And Maldini says, oh, we want to win, we expect to win. It was just, it's very, pensive. And I think it was maybe Steven Gerrard said, I've already played this game 3-4 times in my mind. He's emotionally exhausted. And I don't think that the Milan players, not that they were showing any disrespect or, you know, looking down on their opponent, but their pedigree was a winning pedigree. And the two sides to me just could not be more of a contrast in terms of style of play, but also just experience in these types of situations.
I mean, for you, Stephen, you know, we've obviously, it all ends very well. But in terms of this campaign, this side that embark on this sort of 2004-2005 Champions League season, which is what it is now, I'm guessing there wasn't the expectation that it would end as it did sort of in May when you first sort of embark on that, on the very first steps of that journey.
No, we'd be mad to say that it ended the way we expected. I think we expected better domestically than we got, but we'd have never at any point launched into that Champions League campaign saying we were going to win it. We probably felt we could go a distance in it. You know, I think we'd have been massively disappointed not to have made the knockout stages. And once you make the knockout stages, you know, we were a team that had won the UEFA Cup just 4 years earlier. There's still quite a few of those players that had done that was in the squad. So, you know, I think in a percentage playing terms, we'd have felt that we were, you know, certainly worthy of a place in the last eight. But domestically, we were something of a basket case. I watched some awful football that season on the road. I can remember Crystal Palace away. I think that was around about the semi-final, maybe even between the semi-finals. Andy Johnson scored the only goal of the game, one of the worst Liverpool performances I've ever seen. You know, we won a game earlier in the season at Fulham, at Craven Cottage 4-2. We stank for the first 70 minutes, 2-0 down, and somehow we end up winning 4-2. Igor Biscan scores a screamer that even he looked shocked at scoring. But it was one of the best responses in an away end. There was just something mad about it because, you know, you could see little bright flashes of what Benitez was trying to do. And, you know, those of us who had heard of him and we knew of him, watched, you know, the Spanish football, we knew his Valencia side. You know, we'd been hoping that he was going to bring Aymar and Braja with him. Unfortunately, he didn't. But, you know, once he was signing Alonso and you know, it was and Garcia as well. It was all very, very, you know, it was promising, but it was somewhat scattergun. You know, Benitez struggled to get, to, you know, his head around the domestic game. But in Europe, you know, it seemed he had the measure of it. But even then, you know, in the group stages, you know, we had our problems. You know, we won the first game in a, I don't know, I think a convincing kind of manner against Monaco at Anfield. You know, we won the last game against Olympiacos in dramatic fashion. But what was before was more missed than hit, you know, in between those two games. So, you know, it was very kind of scattergun. It was, you know, bright flash of inspiration and what could be, and then offset by some really awful football. So, you know, no, we'd have never predicted winning the Champions League at the start of the season. We'd have never predicted winning the Champions League, you know, even through the group stages. And you know, once the last 16 kicked off, you know, that's where it starts to think, you know, you start to tick then, because they're very convincing against Bayer Leverkusen. And from there, it's a very different game.
I mean, you know, Gary, you know, obviously, you know, Stephen's there to sort of discuss the Liverpool side, you know, and this is John's game in terms of choices and stuff. But, you know, John sort of, you know, has already mentioned and touched upon the, you know, the quality of that Milan side. And, you know, even for, you know, for myself looking back, you know, to me, there was only ever going to be, you know, and I'd watched Liverpool's sort of journey as they'd sort of, you know, as they'd overcome Olympiacos and then got into the knockouts. And it just kind of, to me, Liverpool's journey just seemed to sort of stumble along, for want of a better word. And you always thought it would probably end at some point, but never did. And so they just sort of rumbled along, whereas Milan just, you know, if ever you were going to sort of bet on a side to win a competition, I mean, you know, that side that lines up, they just seem to have winners just written all over them. You know, they could play in any way they wanted to play. Whatever game their opponents brought, you know, they could deal with it, they could match with it and arguably exceed it in every way, obviously until they get to the final. But obviously in those, you know, leading up to the final, it was just two complete opposites in terms of the smoothness of the journey.
Yeah. You know, I mean, as Steve mentioned, domestic Liverpool have been, I mean, pretty poor. I mean, Chelsea would lead that season with 94 or 95 points, something like that. And I think Liverpool were probably best part of 35 points behind them. And, you know, they'd sort of played through the Champions League games. And I wouldn't say they'd edged through, but, you know, as Steve said, after the group games, which was a bit of a struggle, They did sort of pick up a bit, but you know, Milan were almost like a Ferrari coasting along. You know, they spanked into I would say Holman away. It's strange because they played in the same stadium, but you know, across both legs, and you know, they were won by four or five goals. And I think the only close game they had was the PSV game in the semi final, where they got through in away goals. But strangely enough, That ease with which Milan got to the final, and that sort of scrappy procedure, scrappy progress of Liverpool, may have served Liverpool well, and sort of served Milan ill. Because when they were 3-plonk up in the final at half time, you know, they got the pipe and slippers out, and you know, Liverpool had been sort of battling against, I wouldn't say better opposition, well, perhaps better opposition. You know, I mean, as I say, you know, they played Chelsea in the final, we were sort of 30 odd points clear of them. They played Juve as well. So that had to fight through and become almost case hardened by that sort of battling progress to get to the final. And perhaps Milan, you know, as is often the case in Italian football, 3-plonk up at half time, it's almost like a declaration then. the team that's winning doesn't want to sort of hurt anybody. The team just is losing. It almost accepts, well, don't score anymore. We'll call it quits. So, you guys. But Liverpool weren't going to do that. They fought back, and, you know, in a crazy 6 minutes, turned the game on its head.
It does. I mean, Jack, I guess
that Milan semi-final against PSV, they were outplayed by Hiddink's PSV.
They were.
In both legs of that game. You know, the first leg at the San Siro, yeah, Milan won 2-0, but it was a game dominated by PSV, and the two goals that Milan got were on the break.
Yeah.
You know, and then the second leg, it was a late away goal that saw them through very, very late in that game. Milan were quite unconvincing in the semi-finals, and I think this kind of led to a feeling that while it seemed insurmountable prospect to beat them in the final, there was just that inkling that the door was open.
Because perhaps, I mean, I guess, you know, if you look at
Milan had stumbled in the Serie A title race as well. And the last four games leading up to Istanbul, they conceded 9 goals. So there was an element about them that there was just the merest of a door that was open.
Yeah. I guess if you look at the two lineups though, you know, and you'd say, okay, how many Liverpool players would get into the Milan team? You'd probably raise an argument for Gerrard, but if you're pitching him against Pirlo, you're probably going to lose anyway. It's somewhere between 0 and 9, perhaps, and arguably 0 and 1. But sometimes that doesn't matter. And in this game, that didn't matter.
It's, I mean, you know, coming to you, John, this, and again, you know, certainly with the coach's eye, and hindsight, which is always a great tool to have in your belt as well. But, you know, looking at that Milan side from 1 to 11, your opinion of that side as a fan, and then your opinion of that side again as a coach, and the sheer wealth of talent in every position that was in that starting lineup for Milan.
Oh, it's one of those things where if you're talking to coach about how to set up a team, and then you look to your, I mean, even the Milan bench has got his depth. I mean, Rui Costa's on there, and Sergio, and I mean, people forget that, you know, Carlo Ancelotti is his specialty, you know, these finals and getting teams to, you know, I think at the time has won like 4 trophies in 5 years. And I mean, this is a well-practiced side that is serial winners. I think the one thing that stands out for me was the tepid nature in which once Liverpool scored, it seemed as though Milan, like, it's like a boxing match where they are knocking the opponent down and the opponent keeps getting back up, and they've not exhausted themselves, but then they get caught on the chin and they don't expect to. And I think when I look at this lineup, these aren't players, Bar, Gattuso, and Maldini, and Stam, who are resilient in that type of grittiness. And I think looking at, and again, hindsight is very helpful here, but looking at some of the game footage and the highlights, every miss that Milan makes, and there's Shevchenko couldn't buy a goal, it's like he looks dejected, and it's almost an inevitability that there's a team on the ascendancy, and the team on the ascendancy is not the better team. It's almost Milan's losing, and Liverpool is, you know, that 6 minutes. But it's one of the craziest things that I've seen, because, again, if you partition a game into two halves, which coaches tend to do, the one thing about this nuance that I can criticize is match management wasn't there at all. I mean, it was, they'd done their job, and then I think Liverpool players had seen just how the Milan players exited the field. And, you know, maybe that was, we have nothing to lose, we just need to go after it, we have 45 minutes to do. Or, you know, they maybe sent something in there. But, I mean, that starting lineup is just so stellar that it's almost like they needed someone who was a street fighter in there to counteract what was about to happen.
Based on the fact, you know, this is a slightly churlish question, John, but Is that the starting lineup you would have gone with based on what you know what you just talked about there? Was there almost not too much attacking talent, but was it missing maybe one more player that, like you say there, maybe game management, maybe you had that little bit of steel, knowing that it was always going to be a one-off final, if you like.
You know, it's tough to say. I think one of the hard things for me to do is look at this game and freeze it in time, because there are instances in this game where if there's VAR, it's a completely different outcome. And I hate to bring that in, but it's like Nesta has they argue a handball, and then in the transition, Milan score. It's just like they march right back down. So there's instances where I think this starting lineup was set up to attack. And I don't know that the placement of Pirlo at the top or in front of that back four to pull the strings and collect the ball, and it worked well because, you know, they were attacking well. But then once you see Kiel come off and you see this Benitez make his subs, Milan doesn't really adjust well to what's happening there. And what's interesting with me as a coach is Gerrard is starting to play two or three positions as he's chasing the game. He's starting to drift, and he's, you know, and no one's picking him up. But in the first half, it's Kaká who's doing that. He's drifting. No one's picking him up. He's basically pulling the strings, and Gerrard decides to not fight that battle because they're already losing. So he begins to drift to the side. He begins to serve from deep. He begins to make advanced runs forward, obviously getting the penalty. But it's they didn't adjust, and I think tactically this Milan side played one way and they stuck to the principles. And sometimes as a coach and sometimes as a player, you should be able to adjust to things on the fly. And I think this is a case where their principles are so strong and been so successful and proven over the years. And then the Italians, they are very rigid tactically. And it's not a knock on that. It's just they play to a system, not to a player. And I think this is one of the cases where that happened, and Benitez saw that and made the moves out of necessity, but also tactically.
It's fascinating listening to you, and I knew it would be. And I guess, you know, coming to you then, Stephen, with regards to how Liverpool line up, and you know, I suppose similar sort of questions. You know, is this, you know, was this the best lineup at Benitez's disposal at the time, or is this a lineup that was designed? Well, I want to say to suffocate, but that goes right out the window before most people have taken their seats. But you know, was it a side that was designed really to suffocate and frustrate Milan, or was it a side, you know, that was selected in the beginning? Obviously, you know what happens with Kiel and stuff, but was it a side, you know, that Benitez believed could go and go toe to toe with that Milan side?
No, it was a lineup designed to take the game to Milan, which obviously unraveled very, very quickly. The formation that starts the game is a 4-4-1-1, which is the formation that he later implements when Torres is at the top and Gerrard plays behind. So it's a Benitez formation, but at the time he doesn't have the players to carry him, really. You know, bringing Kiel back in when he'd been unfit and his form had been all over the place was a huge, huge gamble, really. You know, it was a bold move. There was talk of Cisse starting the game, but Barros got the nod instead. But the Kiel inclusion had been mooted for a couple of days. It had been heavily rumoured. It was massively, massively issued over Haman not starting. So when those, you know, we lost Kiel very early, he got that groin injury, so he was out of the game quite quick. And Smicha came on for him. But, you know, within that, the classic Benitez alterations, you know, kicked in because Smicha didn't go straight into where Kiel had played, because Kiel was playing the go-between between midfield and attack. He was the split one as such. What he did is he moved Garcia to that role and Smicha took up a role on the right-hand side. But within all that, you know, we seeded the midfield to Milan, and that was why they prospered so well, because Kaká was running rampant. He was the extra man in midfield, basically. Gattuso was chasing everyone down. So when we were in possession, he was the fast, quick, straight in. Pirlo was, he didn't have a great game, but he was given a very disciplined role, I'd say. So we kind of played into the hands. You know, I couldn't understand why he went for the formation. It was a bid to go at Milan. He'd have watched those PSV games and how well PSV did in going at them. But the half-time change, we've spoken to Jamie Carragher. You know, we've been lucky there, you know, to have a little bit of insight into that dressing room, and that it was meant to be Jimmy Traore that was coming off. You know, he told him shower. That was the phrase that Carragher told us, didn't he? Shower, Jimmy, shower.
Yeah, yeah.
But then it was kind of like Finnan, you know, said, oh, you know, it became clear that he was carrying a little bit of an injury. But as Finnan's saying that he can carry on for a little bit, that wasn't good enough if you know the game's going to go to the extra time. So off comes Finnan, on comes Haman, and we go three at the back. And in a way, I think the injury to Finnan probably helped, as mad as that sounds, because he was a very underrated right-back, Steve Finnan. But not really a centre-back. So to play as a three at the back, Traore was a centre-back as a kid. You know, he came as a centre-back, but he was played at left-back as a necessity. So for him to play the left-sided centre-half was crucial. And it was massive in the fact that at the start of the second half, he clears one off the line. You know, and he doesn't do that if he's playing left back. So as derided as a player, as mocked as a player as he's been, you know, he played quite an important role in that second half. So, you know, it's a different game. And as John said before, once we make our changes and go 3-5-2, which makes, you know, we dominate the midfield then. You know, Gerrard becomes the spur man. We've got Alonso there who can dictate the pace of play. Haman, you know, is just picking the ball off Kaká. You know, it becomes very, very different from there. And as John said, you know, Milan don't respond. There is no response to it. You know, 3-0 up. They, I don't know, maybe feel they don't have to. And then before they know it, it's 3-0, and it's just a state of shock for them. But no, you know, we undeniably picked the wrong starting lineup, but it was done with the best intention.
One thing I want to add there is the role of John Arisa as a left, well, uses left back often, but as a left sided player who's able to maraud up and down the field at that wing, and Gattuso does not pick him up as early as he did in the first half. And with that switch to the three at the back, it's actually freed him up to create way more pressure on that left-hand side to either serve balls in or pull Milan out of their shape and allow Gerrard to roam. And I think as a coach studying that aspect of it, you kind of see it in Liverpool sides now with Robertson not playing as a left back, really as a left wing back, but just having that freedom to use that wing from a player who is normally defensive but can serve a ball, is natural left-footed and is able to be pacey and track. That was one thing that, you know, as a player back then I was watching, and I thought that was one of the strangest adjustments that Milan didn't make, was to pick up Risa on that side, because he was pivotal in Liverpool's ascendancy.
I mean, Gary, this is one of those games where, you know, where to me, you know, you go on YouTube and there's pages and pages of highlights of this game. You know, there's six goals to look at. There's, like you said, there's the double save in extra time. There's penalties. But actually, if you go back and watch the full 120 minutes of this game, you know, and, you know, John's mentioned it, Stephen's mentioned it there, it's actually a fascinating game to watch the intricacies of the game as it's played out. There are so many plots, subplots, changes. You know, it is a fascinating one. Once you overcome 3-0 down, 3-3, you know, penalties, once you can get beyond that and look past that, which is why, you know, my opening question to John, and you look at it almost objectively as a game, it is a fascinating game to watch.
It absolutely is. And, you know, the guys have just been mentioning about the changes and that were made, the changes that weren't made. I think Haman coming on at half time was a crucial change for Liverpool. And Milan had been sort of, I would say, strolling about, but not far short. They'd been well in control of the game, three goals clear. and I'm sure they thought they were home and hosed. But when Hammond came on and Liverpool split to a 3-5-2, also the midfield was contested, and Kaká's space suddenly was filled by a big German guy wearing red, and the freedom he had disappeared. And as John said quite rightly, Risa became more of a potent force going forward, because he was freed from that sort of defensive play, because having five in midfield and Hammond sitting there, it made such a difference. It allowed Gerrard to play more advanced, with less sort of having to sort of be concerned about the space behind him. So, yeah, I mean, but, you know, as you say, lots of goals, lots of incidents. But from a tactical point of view, the change at half-time, I think, was the key thing. And strangely enough, you know, you bring on a defensive midfield player, as Harman was, a holding midfield player, and all of a sudden Liverpool became a potent attacking force. And as Stephen mentioned, Ruttle, there was three goals in that crazy six-minute spell. And, you know, John mentioned earlier that, you know, boxing metaphor, you know, Milan had boxed Liverpool's head off for 45 minutes, and all of a sudden they got tagged on the chin and didn't know what to do. They didn't clear the head for a long time, and by the time they had, Liverpool were level.
I'm not sure how to ask this question here, John, but it's in terms of, you know, in such an incident-packed game, you know, so many incidents, whether it's players coming off early, you know, like, you know, at 3-0 up, a goal in the first minute. But if you could, you know, if you can pinpoint moments, not necessarily goals, but even just moments within those 120 minutes, you know, where did you see the story? You know, if you had to sort of condense it down into three or four moments, you know, how would you summarise the story of this game into key moments?
Oh, I once used the metaphor that this were a Shakespearean tragedy and Queen Mab was involved and she would have convinced people of dreams and whatnot. And I wrote about this, but it's one of resolve and resurgence, because there are moments where, and this is one of the things that stuck out to me the most, was Steven Gerrard. I think he scores a header, hooked, I think, from Risa. In that back line of Stam, Maldini, Crespo, like, how does he, with that type of defensive line, how does he win a header and score against a goalkeeper who's 6'5", 6'7", I'm not sure. But it's a crazy moment, because I think at that point, his reaction is he's waving his arms so fervently that his armband slips off. And it's like this image of a young player who has got the pressure of possible move to Chelsea and all that, and a poor domestic form, and, you know, he could be cornered by any team in the world, possibly this Milan side, and he's trying to literally grab this team, and with the supporters rallying around him, and he's waving his arms frantically, and he pulls up his armband and he shoves his sleeve into it to make sure it doesn't fall back down, as he's just this frail Steven Gerrard who is becoming cemented as a club legend. And it's like that attitude to me, just if I take the coaching side out, take the analysis out, that fandom, that you call it passion, whatever, but that was the moment where I felt like he stole Milan's soul a little bit. Just, it was like, this was, I've risen above these legends of the game. I scored a header and we're not done. And I think that was one of the things that that sums it up for me. I also think there are plays when Dudek save. I think that there's Traore clear off the line. I think that there's some very, very game of inches type stuff here that that sums up how close this game was to being 6-0 or, you know, 3-3. And it's one of those things in finals, which is what you want. This is why we watch as fans. This is why we can put sometimes our footballing brain aside and just be caught up in the moment, because I think, and again, in hindsight, listening to some of the commentary, you know, one of the things that someone said was, you know, how did Milan go to not winning this after 3-0, you know, being 3-0 up? And then at 3-3, there's I forgot who said it, Steve, you may be able to back me up on this, but it was, what a match, what a night, Turkish delight for Liverpool, they have come back from the dead, the unthinkable is happening. And that was what everyone's feeling, regardless of who you were supporting. And I think that's what, you know, really cemented this final for me, is it had every subplot of a game that you really want, I think, from just a fan perspective.
It's a great answer. And like you say, those little nuances, you know, and Gerard taking it, you know, right down to that micro moment of Gerard's armband. I mean, obviously, Stephen, you were there. So, you know, you're in Istanbul and I guess you're seeing a different perspective. You get a, you know, you're living the atmosphere. You know, we get it through the television and it was incredible. But you're actually there and you see things that we don't see. And you're a party to shifts and moments and feelings in the stadium. And I suppose same question to you, but from a Liverpool fan's perspective or from the perspective of somebody who was there that night and went through those emotions, in the crowd, was there a moment that the sort of Liverpool fans as a collective picked up on and thought, this is it, you know, this is where it's going to change?
I'd probably say once that first goal goes in, there's just a bit of relief. You know, it's kind of like we've got one back. You know, we've stemmed the tide a little bit. You know, I think at half time we've just thought, you know, just play better in the second half. You know, let's not have this as 5 or 6-0. I mean, you can't be under any major illusions there that 3-0 down, having conceded the second and the third so late in the second half as well, that you've got a hell of a job on to, you know, to stem the tide. So yeah, you know, the first goal is kind of like it's celebrated, but it's celebrated via relief. But once that second one goes in, and there's only 2 minutes that separate the first and the second goal, it's just bedlam. It's absolute bedlam. From that moment on, I think the crowd, certainly those around me, were well within the realms of this is only going to go one way. Prior to the match, you know, I think the atmosphere, the feeling was that we could do it. You know, like I said earlier on, there was that concept that this is a majestic Milan side, but the door was, you know, it was open. You know, and we had the players who could just sneak through. I can remember before the game, stuff like, it was Xavi Alonso and Luis Garcia having a conversation on the pitch in the warm-up. And Alonso put his arm around Garcia's shoulder and he just swept his other hand, three quarters of the way around the stadium. And you could see the conversation that they're having. It was just, where are the Liverpool supporters? And because we had three sides and the Milan supporters were just at the far end, it blew Garcia's mind. You could see him shake his head. And then he ran off, and I think it was to, I can't remember who it was, I think it was Risa or someone like that. And he told him as well. And he did the same gesture and he swept his hand around to say, look, Liverpool supporters, three quarters of the stadium. And you could just sense that there's this, I don't know, something was in the air. It was mad how it worked. So even at 3-0 down, you know, you kind of, well, the match isn't over yet. We're still here. It's still the Champions League final. And we're going to enjoy ourselves. So when that first goal goes in, you know, it is that sense of relief. It's kind of like, oh, great, we've got one back. Second one goes in, all better off. It's off and away. You know, there's little things like extra time when there were two interceptions that Carragher made. He blocked two crosses, really important blocks. And he got cramp on the back of them. And eventually, he stops one. And then Dave Galley comes on and treats him. And then he comes back on the pitch. And within 30 seconds, he's thrown himself into exactly the same block. Virtually identical. And you don't see it on the TV. But when the game goes back up the other end of the field, Carragher's in so much pain that he has to claw himself up on the netting of the pitch of the goalpost to get back on his feet to prepare for the next attack. It's just stuff like that. It was this element of stubbornness and a kind of belief, and it totally psyched Milan out. You know, Milan were just within this state of shock almost. So the only thing you can describe it as, you know, Liverpool dominated the second half. You know, we always talk about how well Milan played in that first half and how dominant they were, and they were. But there was more to that second half for Liverpool than just those 6 minutes. as mad as that sounds, you know, so much is made of those 6 minutes. It kind of downplays the rest of the half that Liverpool are playing that match.
I mean, you know, to you, Gary, you know, sat there nodding your head at everything Stephen's saying yeah. there. Yeah. But I just want to come back to Steven Gerrard. And I suppose, you know, Steven Gerrard was associated with Liverpool for so long, you know, spends all his majority of his playing career. Yes, he goes to Los Angeles. But, you know, he's so ingrained in sort of Liverpool folklore. And you kind of forget how young he was, you know, at this game. And it's followed quite closely by obviously the FA Cup final against West Ham, which I think is the following season, Stephen, 2006 FA Cup final. But that, you know, for you, Gary, you know, is that 2005 Champions League final, is that the sort of start of the Steven Gerrard, not myth, because it's not a myth, you know, it's fact, but is that where the sort of, where Steven Gerrard becomes this almost overseer of Liverpool Football Club?
Well, if it wasn't the start, it was certainly the sort of cementing of it, shall we say. You know, so many clubs have iconic players. You know, you have Roy Keane at Man United, you could have Terry at Chelsea. Gerrard at Liverpool fits right into that as well. And it was perhaps, it sounds crazy to say, but it was perhaps really important that it was Gerrard that scored the first goal for Liverpool. And then I was watching the highlights earlier today because just sort of swatting up before tonight. And he goes back to the halfway line, whirling his arms around, you know, driving it around, you know, this ain't over. And then, of course, when they score again so quickly, you know. You asked me earlier about Champions League finals or European Cup finals. And sometimes these games seem to have a fate that's written and the players are almost irrelevant to it because something is going to happen. And it happened with the United Bayern Munich game. It happened to Chelsea Bayern Munich game. And it happened in this game as well when teams are, you know, to all intents and purposes beaten. And, you know, all logic says just try and keep the damage down, as Stevie said. But when Gerrard scored that goal, it meant more than if it had goal had come from Smica or Risa or Barros or anybody else, because it was Gerrard and he was saying, you know, this ain't over, guys. And so just to, you know, to underline the question you asked me, yeah. As I say, if it wasn't the start of the legend, it certainly built a big part of it from there going forward. Because when Gerrard had belief, you know, Liverpool had belief and, you know, it flowed those next few minutes. And as Steve mentioned after, it's important that, you know, as Stevie said, you know, those 6 minutes can almost camouflage the rest of that second half when Liverpool were far and away the better team than they'd been in the first period. And perhaps it was the tactical change, bring Haman on and go to a back three. Perhaps it was all about the momentum. Perhaps it was about Gerrard scoring the goal and giving new hope. I mean, perhaps it was a combination of all of them. But the game changed massively when Gerrard scored.
The complex thing about Gerrard was that as confident as he could be, he was often wracked by self-doubt as well. You know, when the quarter-final draw was made, for instance, you know, it pitted us against Juventus, which was an absolutely massive game for many reasons. But the draw was made as well for the semi-final, so it turned into a tennis draw, basically. It was, you know, you knew who you were going to get in the semi-finals. It was either going to be Chelsea or Bayern Munich. And then you looked at the other side of the draw and you, you know, you could predict that Milan were going to come through it. And when that draw was made and how difficult the route looked for Liverpool, Gerrard had made some kind of comments about, well, you know, that's the end of it for us now, or you know, it was a good run while it lasted. And this throwaway comment kind of like got back to Benitez and he confronted Gerrard with it to say something along the lines of, look, you know, if you as the captain can't believe we can do it, then how do we make the rest of the team believe we can do it? And that was it. So that about face, kind of that turn on that pivot of that quarter final was probably where Liverpool winner. I mean, I can remember the draw being made and being at work and hearing it on the radio and tongue in cheek even then. Saying, oh, Juventus, Chelsea, Milan, or Doddle. and kind of like almost predicted it to be. But part of me feeling that, you know what, why not? You know, and that was the thing, that there was a part of Gerrard that couldn't always buy into the why not concept. At one point, you know, it was odd that it was a season, and around about then, Gerrard was Liverpool's penalty taker. He took over the job after Owen went, and he missed quite a few in those early days. And later on in his career, when he had that kind of centred, you know, he'd centred with himself, very rarely missed one. Very, very rarely missed one. But back then, you know, it was odd. I think we had something like 15 penalties that season and scored like 8 or 9 of them. You know, we had quite a high ratio of missed penalties, and Gerrard was the penalty taker. I can remember certain games that season when he'd step up and take a penalty, and I wouldn't feel confident that he'd scored it. But this just played into that just subtle self-doubt that he had. But this was something that Benitez, you know, changed in him, you know, and, you know, the first flourish of that is that final and the way that he celebrates that first goal, and he tries to get the crowd going and his team going.
Am I right, Steve, that the Juve game, the away leg, Alonso played and he wasn't really fit, but he played because Gerrard was injured, and he bossed the game, basically, from playing as a defensive midfield player. Is that the game I'm thinking of?
I think he came, if I remember it right, I think he came back for the second leg in Turin. We've been absolutely majestic for the first 20 minutes there, where Garcia scores this wonderful looping goal. Hippier gets one at the back post. But we eventually concede one. Both Dudek and Kirkland were injured, and Scott Carson played that night, and one crept under him.
I'm thinking about the Juve game in Turin, yeah.
Yeah, and then a fortnight later is where Alonso comes back. But Alonso had been out for three and a half months. He'd sustained a broken ankle on New Year's Day against Chelsea.
That's right.
Lampard caught him. There was nothing particularly malicious in the challenge. It was just one of those. It was a late challenge, but it was the type of late challenge that happens, you know, 5, 10, 20, 30 times in a football match. But yeah, he came back and he bossed that. You know, Alonso was a wonderful, wonderful player. You know, he was still young at the time. I think he was younger than Gerrard at that point, you know, at all points. But, you know, you're saying that Gerrard, what, about 23 or so maybe? Or 25, no. So Alonso was about 23. So, you know, a player who'd never won anything. The interesting thing was, before that game, and I was reading up on some of the pre-match articles, the articles on the day of the game I was reading this morning, and it was like the press conference that was mentioned earlier on, and that the trophy was there. And, you know, it's Milan sent out to do the press conference on the, you know, the day before the game, the last big press conference before the day of the game. And they send out Maldini and Seedorf. And this is Maldini with, you know, he's won 4 European Cups / Champions Leagues. He's lost a further 2 finals. This is his 7th final. It's Clarence Seedorf, the only player to win the Champions League with 3 different clubs. Certainly by that time, you know, he'd won it with Ajax, he'd won it with Real Madrid. You know, and here he was. He'd already won it with Milan 2 years earlier. So these two players, it was, and the line in the article was, it was a proper statement of intent. It was a show as your medals, put your medals on the table moment, because at the same press conference, it was a joint press conference. So out went Maldini and Seedorf and had their say, and then out came Sami Hupia and Alonso, and it was, you know, as talented as they were. This was Hippier saying that, you know, it might be my only chance to win this. And it was Alonso who, at that point, as talented and precocious a talent as he was, didn't have a winner's medal to his name. You know, and it's just stuff like that. And Maldini was quite, not derogatory, but matter of fact about Liverpool as well. You know, he kind of downplayed them and said that, you know, they set out to stifle. And he was functional in what he said. Nothing wrong in what he said. But again, it just made that gap between the two all the more pronounced, which again laid into the stunning nature of what would happen 24 hours later.
It's just sort of listening to you all speak there, there's just a couple more bits that I want to talk about before we finish. But a question for you, John, and I've still not quite worked out how to word it yet in my head, but I'm gonna give it a go anyway, and we'll somehow understand what the question is. But in terms of, you know, in games like this and leading up to a big final, does sort of cultural heritage, cultural history of how the game is played in that particular country. So when you have, you know, Italian football, it's Catenaccio, it's very, you know, it's 1-0, you know, like you say, lock the game up. And that's what you'd have expected from an Italian side. And I appreciate it. You know, these are now sides that are very pan-European and pan-global with regards to starting lineups. But then you have against an English side whose tradition and heritage is never give up, never say die. And, you know, does that play any part in this game? You know, 3-0 up at halftime. I'm not saying it, you know, could only an English side do it. I don't mean it like that. But in terms of cultural heritage of these two sides, like you said, you expect an Italian side to have this game locked up after minute one, going 1-0 up, you know, and traditionally that would do us. And yet you're playing against an English side who are 3-0 down at halftime, but you know they're still going to come back until the 90th minute. And does that play a part in this game?
You have to say it does. And when I think back to, I think the second goal, there's a shot of it that is so close to hitting Milan Baros in the hand, and it soars in. And you look at just the way Milan can see these goals, they're antithetical to the way the game should be played and how goals should be conceived. Like, these aren't clean goals. These are scrappy goals. These are, you know, again, getting caught on the chin, and then as you stumble up, another one comes around your ear. Like, these are the shots delivered. These are things that, you know, once Liverpool decides to change the way they play and approach that second half, it's Milan's in there all whites. Now they're all whites of blood stains. And I don't mean this to be like, you know, it was just a fight, but this was against the script was ripped up. And when I started this, you know, this talk, it was, there's a game played on paper, there's a game played on the pitch. And I think for the first 45 minutes, Liverpool had played that game on paper. And what should have happened definitely happened. That narrative was, the story arc was perfect. But then when you go against it and you rip up that script and you decide, okay, well, that hasn't worked. We're going, and again, I say this as fine margins and inches. I mean, seeing Carragher, hearing that story from Steven, just pulling himself up and seeing, you know, just how, you know, he's laid out on the pitch and he cannot get up. And, you know, Dudek comes and taps him on the head and almost has to haul him up. And it's one of these things where someone who's willing to suffer for that long and play that way, and it's effective. I don't think Milan had an answer for that. And you saw in the penalty shootout, Liverpool's players grabbed the ball and walked up there composed almost. And Milan, they looked scared. That's not, you know, probably appropriate, but they looked like the weight of the world was on their shoulders. Shevchenko, Pirlo, I mean, Pirlo's run-up was, for a player of his class, was almost like the strength had gone from his feet. And he passed it in. I think Sergino skied it first. I mean, he just, it was casual. And I think that's the word we use as coaches, it's casual. And Liverpool, culturally, I think it was a blue-collar performance. I don't know how else to say it, but it was so gritty and so defined and clawing their way back. And I think that 6 minutes, as important as that is, momentum in football matches is everything. And one of the things that is sticking with me is the final two goals for Milan came at the end of the first half and they had momentum, but then they had a 15-minute break and they, you know, fans are cheering and this, that. And by the time Liverpool break and get those three goals, there is no time for them to kind of see what's happened to them. It's like every goal that goes in, they can't believe it. And it's incredible to see the footage now, but I look back on this and I really think that this performance culturally, it took the best elements of all the players on that Liverpool side. And I don't say that they unified, but there were elements that could only be present with a team that hadn't won at the scale of Milan. Like, it just, Milan expected to win one way. If they're conceded, it had to be a beautiful goal, and Liverpool didn't play that way. You know, it's goals going in, like looping headers and a shot that almost hits a player in the arm and Buta can't react. And it's just, you know, a penalty save. And then he's, you know, the player who, you know, takes it is putting it in the roof of the net. It's just unbelievable the way that these goals are going in. And I don't think Milan could really adjust.
Brilliant, you know, great answer. Gary, I'll just sort of come to you next just before we start to wrap it up, but at 3-3, and again, hindsight is a great thing, but was there only ever one winner at 3-3?
Well, you never know, because Liverpool turned the game on its head in 6 minutes with the goals. But, you know, as John said, momentum is a big thing in football, and belief in Milan, belief must have been sort of, if not destroyed, and certainly very, very damaged by that period where Liverpool have said, you know, you might have been 3 goals clear in 45 minutes, but we've got 3 goals back in 6, and you know, there's plenty of time left yet, Tiger. I think, you know, if you're a betting man at half time, you'd be piling on Milan. 6 minutes into the second half, well, after that 6 minutes, not 6 minutes in the second half, but after that 6 minutes where Liverpool got those 3 goals back, you're going to be back in Liverpool, because belief is so important, momentum is so important, and sometimes, especially in Champions League games, in European Cup finals, Champions League finals, it just seems to be written that, you know, no matter almost what you do on the pitch, it's going to happen. And, you know, and Liverpool have got back, and yeah, just seemed to be one winner.
Stephen, just quickly for you, obviously, you know, you're there at the stadium. You know, penalties is never an easy thing, and obviously when it's your own club, but was it, you know, as John's mentioned there, you know, obviously we have hindsight, you know, the camera practically takes you right into the eyes and the soul of the Milan players, but obviously you're looking at it from distance, but was there trepidation, and there's always trepidation in penalty shootout, but as a fan in the stadium, was there an air of confidence based on what you'd seen sort of over extra time and the second half?
There was a pensiveness as the first penalty was taken, but once that first penalty was missed by Milan, we all just felt that that's it. You know, this is only going to slide Liverpool's way. Extra time essentially broke Milan. They brought on Cugino. They dictated extra time. Fatigue set in for Liverpool. You'll understand that, you know, we made our first substitution halfway through the first half. The second one was made at half time. You know, Milan was stronger in extra time, without a shadow of a doubt. The double save by Dudek, you know, I didn't know it at the time, but, you know, you look at the footage and the reaction of Dudek, the way he just nods and smiles, that's where it's finished. You know, that's instilled him with the belief that the ball isn't going to go past him. You know, he's not going to concede a goal in the rest of extra time, and that, you know, anything's, you know, if he needs to be the hero, he will be the hero. Serginho was a massive influence on Milan once he came on, to the point that Gerrard was sent over to mark him. You know, so Serginho playing down the left, Gerrard essentially became, you know, a right back for which he played as a kid for Liverpool. You know, a lot of his early first team experience was played at right back for Liverpool. And he just closed him every time. You know, he closed the door on him. You know, if you wanted to watch any point in that match, you know, it'd be worth just watching from when Serginho comes on and his battle with Gerrard. And it's just stuff like that. Again, Cafu was just in awe of Carragher. You know, prior to the match, you know, Cafu was interviewed and you know, he said that, you know, as good as Steven Gerrard is, everything's Carragher. You know, he fully appreciated the defender that Carragher was, and he knew him. You know, he knew his game. You know, he was an avid Premier League watcher, so he knew exactly who Carragher was. You know, he knew that he'd covered at full back before taking the centre back role. So for Carragher to be doing what he was doing, for Gerrard to be shutting the door on Serginho so often, you know, it was like this. Milan had this devastation over the 3 goals, zoned for the rest of the second half. seemed to come to the senses in extra time, but then couldn't do anything about it. Seen this double Shevchenko miss saved. And it was just one, you know, indicator after another that they were not going to win. So when that first penalty is high and wide, and then the second one saved, you know, from our perspective up the other end of the pitch, you know, it was all over. So even when Risa, you know, has his penalty saved, and that's a great save by Dida. That's a well-positioned penalty. Yes, it's low down, but, you know, it's close to the post. You know, even that, you know, the dust was in the eyes from the second penalty, from the first penalty being missed.
This is a game that will be talked about for as long as the game exists. And just one last question for you, John. Well, I've got two questions. The second one, the last one's a really quick one. But last big question for you, John. How important was it for the fragility, psychology of those Milan players and that side that they got to play Liverpool again 2 years later in a Champions League final and sort of rectify what must have been horrific psychological damage that was done in Istanbul?
I think it probably, for a lot of football purists, said it right. You know, like, it was retribution, a chance for, you know, to make it up. And I think one of the things that I remember in that final 2 years later was, this isn't going to have the magic. it just didn't have that air about it. And obviously, you know, teams had changed a bit and tactics, you know, are what they are. But, you know, when, you know, late goals from Inzaghi and even, you know, getting a 90-minute, you know, Dirk Kuyt strike as consolation, it was kind of like he felt as though the magic had gone. And again, for a Milan fan, I'm sure it was retribution. I'm sure this is setting the narrative right. This is, you know, this is a great addition to our pedigree. But I think the thing that lasts longest is that defeat 2 years prior. I think that is I wouldn't call it a blight, and I wouldn't call it anything, you know, negative, but it's like, even looking back, like, this one doesn't mean as much because they ripped us apart at a moment when we had been, like, it's always been argued whether Milan lost that game or Liverpool won that game. I don't know where, you know, people make that decision, but I firmly believe that, you know, Milan winning 2 years later, they reestablished continental powerhouses, you know, they set things right to a degree, but I think there's probably some satisfying revenge, but the heartbreaking defeat isn't as good as a satisfying revenge, in my opinion. I can't see how it would be.
It's a great answer. And I suppose my final question, and I know what Gary's answer will be to this because he usually answers it the same way. And I pretty much know what Stephen's answer is going to be to this. But for you, John, in the 2005 Champions League final, did the right team win?
I think if you look at it as a fan, as a neutral, if you're looking just for pure entertainment and passion, I think the right team won. If you look at it from what should happen, what could happen, and then what did happen, I think you feel like lightning struck and, you know, the footballing gods were not in favor of the side that should have walked it. It's like they gave them a taste, and then at the end it was some, you know, tragic hero myth where it's like it all comes apart at the end. And again, it's almost like it would be a discredit to Liverpool's effort into the miracle of these things. People call it the miracle of Istanbul for a reason. And I don't know that serves it well, but I think the right team won if we look at what finals really are for what they were. I think in terms of looking at finals in isolation, the right team won, and that's why we still talk about it.
Brilliant. I'm going to ask you the same question, Gary. I pretty much know what the answer would be, but for you, the right team won?
Well, in a penalty shootout, they scored more times than Milan.
So there you go.
There you go. Yeah, I mean, I know that's a bit simplistic, but, you know, it's also true. And because, you know, okay, Milan bossed the first half and Liverpool bossed the second half and the extra time was a bit in the balance, you know, and Stevie might be right that Milan had the better of it. He's probably right there, but momentum is such a massive thing in football. and coming back from 3-0 down, you ain't going to lose that game. So yeah, best team won. Not the best team. On paper, Milan were the better team. On the pitch, on the grass, where it mattered, Liverpool won the game.
I'm not going to ask you that question, even because it's too simple of a question. But as a man who was there, your single abiding memory of that night in Istanbul.
It's just so many, to be honest. You know, it could do a podcast just of memories alone. But yeah, I can probably when that last penalty is saved, when Dudek saves Shevchenko's penalty, I end up about 7, 8, 9 rows in front of where I started, and still to this day have no recollection of how that happened. I'm actually on camera. I'm actually on the when they pan across the footage of the supporters at the end after the penalty and the celebrations are going on. There's a fella who rips his shirt off and waves. That's not me, by the way. he waves it above his head in that, you know, the twirling scarf way that Liverpool adopted under Gerard Houllier, the LALA. And he just takes his shirt off. And I creep across the top right-hand corner of the screen, working my way back to where I started from. And then I just see myself at the top of the screen get embraced by kind of like one of the people I was with. It was just that whole improbability of it all. I can't give you one specific moment, but it was just everything about it, and it was improbable, yet it was probable. You know, it was both things at once. You know, it was wild.
Brilliant. Like I say, and I'll say it every time, that, you know, I do have the best job here with these podcasts, and certainly when, you know, guests like you come on, John, and I've got a whole new audience to throw questions at, because I'm always throwing questions at Stephen and Gary, but one, you know, when I've got a new audience to throw questions at, or who can come at it from a slightly different perspective, certainly from a coach's perspective, it just makes my night even better. Thank you ever so much for coming on and joining us.
Oh, I appreciate it. It's always a pleasure to talk to you guys. And I always learn so much more than I thought I knew, which is a good thing. And, you know, I'm just honored to be on the podcast with you guys and chat this stuff up, because it's not something you get to do every day. So I appreciate the opportunity.
No problem at all. Stephen, obviously for you, I guess it's just one of them great nights that you just don't get sick of talking about.
Oh, well, that's it. You know, how can I not love doing this? You know, and then, yeah, it's been brilliant and a little bit surreal as well, because as we've been going along with it, it's like little things that have disappeared into the ether of the mind that pop back into the mind and stuff like that. It's like, you know, the being 4, 8, 9, 10 rows in front of where you started. It's all the mad stuff like that. Absolutely ball. I'd have absolute ball doing this one. And Garcia's goal was way over the line in the semi-final.
I know we didn't even get to it, did we? Gary, we've come to terms with the fact this is your series, right? That's now just come to an end.
Yeah. I mean, it's been a great series. I'm so chuffed. The games we've had have been so different. You know, you mentioned earlier, we talked some about events outside of the game, some about events before, some about the events afterwards. But this and the last one we spoke about have been very much events of the game. And it's been, I've enjoyed it immensely. And this is a great game. Some finals, I mean, you know, we did the World Cup final, the 1970 World Cup final. It was a great contest because Brazil were you know, far away the better team in the end. And this was a great contest. So it's a great way to finish. And it wasn't over the line, by the way.
Well, when we do series two, which is where it's the semi-final word, and people get to talk about great semi-finals. But no, hopefully you'll get commissioned for a second series, Gary, and we can go again with more finals.
Yeah, it's been great, and you know, we had some great guests on. John is just sort of has hit the same height as the guys we've had on here, and it's been great fun. So the series has worked really well. Well chuffed, well pleased.
Brilliant. Obviously, all that's left for me to say is, you know, thanks again, guys. And obviously, thank you to everyone who's listening. And please join us again next time on the Lob Podcast with These Football Times. Thank you and goodbye.
Many thanks for joining us today on The Lob, a These Football Times production. For more of our content, check out our award-winning print magazine featuring some of the game's foremost writers, artists and photographers, exploring areas of the game rarely covered in high-end print. For now, we look forward to you joining us again soon.